In this week's programme, John Banville's novel Ancient Light, which has an opening line that's more Benjamin Black than Banville. Billy Gray was my best friend, and I fell in love with his mother. The narrator grows up to be the actor Alexander Cleve, well known to us from the author's previous work. The actor is cast in a movie as Alex Vander, whom we've also met before. Vander is a controversial European writer who settled in California. The actor asks a researcher on the film to try to locate Mrs. Gray, the woman he fell in love with 50 years before. The reconstruction of a childhood love affair offers rich pickings to a writer forever engrossed with the tension between discovery and invention. As in all of Banville's work, what stops us in our tracks is the prose style. He's really a painter manqué. With me, our regular fiction reviewer Julia Carlson and Derek Hand, who's the author of a book about John Banville. First, an extract from the novel. Derek, you've chosen a passage. Perhaps you'd set it up for us.
Well, it's from the opening of the book, and in many ways it sets out the plot line, as in trying to remember about this early love affair with Mrs. Gray. But also we can see the kind of concerns of Alexander Cleve as the writer of his memoir. It's about words, about finding the right words, about an interest in words. It's about language, its rhythms and its movements. Again, you talked about tension there. There's always a tension in Banville's work, but certainly in Cleve, between a desire for preciseness but an acknowledgement at the same time that words are slippery, that they are uncertain. So that anxiousness is sort of running through. And there's a wonderful bit when he talks about the idea of moving towards death. And I choose to salvage from, I shall experience except as a final full stop. And I think that kind of imagery, it is about writing, about the process of writing, about the act of writing. So it's not just telling a story, it's about writing a story.
What do I recall of her? Here in these soft, pale days at the lapsing of the year. Images from the far past crowd in my head, and half the time I cannot tell whether they are memories or inventions. Not that there is much difference between the two, if indeed there is any difference at all. Some say that without realizing it, we make it all up as we go along, embroidering and embellishing, and I am inclined to credit it, for Madame Memory is a great and subtle dissembler. When I look back, all is flux, without beginning and flowing towards no end, or none that I shall experience, except as a final full stop. The items of flotsam that I choose to salvage from the general wreckage, and what is life but a gradual shipwreck, may take on an aspect of inevitability when I put them on display in their glass showcases, but they are random, representative perhaps compellingly so, but random nonetheless.
An extract there from John Banville's novel Ancient Light, read by Stephen Brennan. What did you make of the book, Derek?
It's familiar ground in terms of Banville's most recent fiction about the past and remembering and acts of remembering and the present. It moves almost seamlessly and reversals between tragedy and comedy. At times it seems as if the past is the comedic moment, the grapplings and the gropings of the young 15-year-old with Mrs. Gray. And then the present moment is the moment of tragedy, but that reverses at times. And I think Banville is so in control of the narrative and of the story. I mean, you gave a little plot summary at the beginning, and at times it matters and at times it doesn't.
Julia, what just your overall reaction to this novel?
I enjoyed the novel very much, and I think that it's a novel. People think of Banville when he's writing as John Banville, as a writer who's inaccessible. But I would say that this is an extremely accessible novel. You said that the opening line could have been something from Benjamin Black. This certainly isn't a Benjamin Black novel by any means, but it certainly is very accessible for a reader.
The question of setting it in his, I mean, you wrote a book about it, Derek. Where would you locate this in his overall output?
Well, I suppose he's been writing a long time and it's a life in writing. So you do have, you know, the early, the middle and the late. And then you have Benjamin Black, of course, this other persona. I mean, this is a late work in the sense of it's a work of the last number of years or his last number of works that sort of deal with somebody aging. It's beyond a midlife crisis. It's about looking back. It's about sort of trying to gauge what went right in one's life and what went wrong. And there's a certain tone that say the sea possessed and this novel possessed, as Eclipse and Shroud did. It's all about atmosphere, and it's both wistful, mournful, but also wry, in the sense of looking back and realising, oh my goodness, I could have done this, I should have done that, but I did none of those things.
Julia, he's concerned with whether he's inventing or recalling the truth of that. Did you find that a bit too much on the self-conscious side, or were you easy with it the whole way through?
I was easy with it the whole way through. I didn't think that it was overly self-conscious, and I thought that the kind of the investigation of memory and invention that goes on in the novel is very well connected with the story as it develops. For example, he's writing about the fragmentary nature of the way in which we live, in which we understand our lives. And one of the strongest images from the early part of the novel is the moment when he first sees Mrs. Gray, the woman with whom he has an affair, naked, as he puts it, not nude. And she's reflected in a mirror, a three-way mirror. And he sees her in terms of her body parts rather than in terms of the whole. And this is picked up But it's picked up metaphorically all the way through the novel in terms of this discussion of the unities and indeed an actor talking about this.
Called, she's perceived in a different way to others in there. What about this question of the problem he has with naming things? Again, it's related to the point we've just been talking about.
Well, it is that. It's the idea of you know, being, things being disconnected and fragmented. His desire is to have a whole vision of Mrs. Gray, which is always going to be denied him. But that doesn't mean that you don't strive for that coherence in terms of your perception. And the same is true of the words. And one thing I noticed this in this novel that I hadn't seen in previous novels is that he appeals to the reader. Don't you remember how cold it used to be? That, you know, before there was central heating, that kind of sense of the coldness and dampness in the morning and
Reminds us, has he not done as much of that before?
Not that kind of appealing to the reader in that kind of way. I mean, like directly sort of addressing the reader. Don't you remember? In many ways, all novelists want to do that. They want to sort of make a connection with the reader. But it's an interesting thing that I just felt he was sort of doing that this time. It's only on a number of occasions. But it is striving for the right word and then taking a word or a phrase and sort of holding it up to sort of consider it. And as he says, the old words, sometimes those old words that you know, have fallen out of use.
There are some great old words in here, actually. Yeah. For example, one that he draws attention to is the word assignation. Yes. And he and Mrs. Gray are having an assignation as they walk along the boardwalk.
He's asking, what do you call it, a tryst or an encounter? But in fact, assignation is something he likes. But what about, everybody talks about going to the dictionary when reading Bamble. You have a skirl of fading laughter, a scumble sort of, all of that. Where is that going? In a way, he mocks that himself in different passages in different ways.
Well, there's a wonderful section, and there is a very self-conscious moment, and Banville himself has turned up, I suppose, in various guises throughout his fiction from the early work right at the moment. But in terms of this movie that's been made, it's been made out of a biography about Alex Axel Vander, and it's been written by this J.B., who is John Banville. And you have Alexander Cleeve talk about Banville in such a way. And I have to say, as an academic writing a book, I think, oh, yes, I could have written this. This could have explained beautifully Banville's style. It's rhetorical. It's, as you said, rhetorical in the extreme, dramatically elaborated, wholly unnatural, synthetic and clotted. It is a style such as might be forged by a minor court official in Byzantium, say, a former slave whose master generously allowed him the freedom of his extensive and eclectic library, a freedom the poor fellow all too eagerly availed of himself.
Yes, he's mocking himself. He's well-read, but not a systematic reader. That
not
kind
a systematic,
of thing.
But also, I think, you know, the use of those words, it's that kind of poetic moment when, in many ways, that's what poetry does. It makes us look at everyday words in a fresh way. And Banville has always been brilliant at doing that, at making us stop and look at words, ordinary words.
Well, Julia, in what context do you see all that adjective loading? I mean, where is it leading? Is it simply a matter, essentially, of foregrounding language? Is that the context in which we should look at it?
I think that this book is different in that kind of way to a lot of the earlier work, and that the kind of attention to language is not as, it's not that it's not as strong here, really, but it's that with this book, you aren't running to the dictionary in the same way that you are in a lot of earlier Banville.
Mind you, I thought he got stuck in at the V's for a while. You have the vermiform corridors, viscid water, voluted ears. The V's figure quite a bit. But I take your point. I mean, in other words, not as much as
No. But there is a very clear interest in kind of the poetic quality of language. In fact, I think that one of the one of the kind of images that I found very strong, and one of the main subjects in the novel too, has to do with bereavement and mourning, and the loss of his daughter Cass, the effect that this has had on his relationship with his wife. But there is one moment when he's writing about this and describes mourning as a constant parching deluge. And just the contrast of that, the idea of the deluge.
I'll tell you what's a very fine image. The wax of steel convictions. Resonated with me.
And I think, you know, Julia's right about it being about sort of mourning. And it's mourning the past and it's mourning the present or the more recent past. And that's what I feel is the qualitative difference between this work and the Benjamin Black work that Banville does, and indeed the early work. And it is that striving towards some sense of a whole picture of a character. Because in many ways, Cleeve is both the hero here, but he's also a reprehensible character. Isn't he? I mean,
I wouldn't go so far as to say that he's reprehensible.
He has his flaws.
He's self-absorbed. He's egotistical. But he also is self-mocking. Yes. At one point, he says that he's like one of Shaw's pompous, tendentious characters. He's aware of his faults.
But in many ways, you could argue that what the problem for Alexander Cleeve is that he doesn't learn anything. He has learned nothing from his affair when he was younger with Mrs. Gray. He's learned nothing from his life with his wife, and he's learned nothing from his relationship with his daughter.
Which is odd for an actor,
But it's that sort of... I think, a problem for the earlier stories of Cleeve as well, is that the idea of, well, do you learn anything from life, from these experiences? And what I'm trying to... maybe I've been a little sort of devil's advocate here, but at some level... I feel the juxtaposition of both those moments, the past and the present. And has he learnt anything?
Well, there is a lot of doubling up in the novel, where the past is repeated or looked at again through the lens of the present. And this becomes particularly apparent with the development of the film plot in the novel, where all the people who work in film seem to have names like Dawn Devonport, who's the starring actress.
Marcy
Merriweather.
Turn to the women. You've chosen a passage, Julia. Perhaps you'd set it up for us.
I have, and it's a passage about his relationship with Mrs. Gray, the woman 20 years his senior, with whom he has an affair when he's 15 years old. And it's about the way in which she introduces him to frailty and failing, and to the whole idea of frailty and failing. Up until this time, his only sense of a woman has been from a woman he's seen in a shop who's wearing a mannequin in a shop, or a few little gropes in the cinema with a girl his own age by the name of Hattie. And he finds the idea of Mrs. Gray's humanity, her flesh, the whole experience of encountering her physicality, a frightening but also a very tempting kind of introduction to adulthood, I suppose you'd say.
Mrs. Gray taught me many lessons, the first and most precious of which was to forgive another human being for being human. I was a boy and therefore had in my mind's eye the platonically perfect girl, a creature bland as a mannequin that did not sweat or go to the lavatory, that was docile, adoring, and fabulously compliant. Mrs. Gray was as unlike this fantasy as could be. She only had to do her laugh, a high whinny in the sinuses with a deep diaphragm note underneath, to send that lifeless dummy flying in tatters from my head. It was not a smooth substitution, the actual woman for the imagined ideal. In the early days I found Mrs. Gray's fleshiness itself disconcerting, at certain moments in certain postures. Remember, up to then my knowledge of the female form had been confined to the Kaiser Bondor lady's legs and the bud-like breasts that Hetty Hickey had let me fondle in the Alhambra's smoky darkness years before. Though Mrs. Gray was not all that much more imposing in stature than Hetty, at times she seemed to me, in our early days at least, a giantess looming over me, a figure of unassailable erotic power.
An extract there from Ancient Light, a new novel by John Banville, read by Stephen Brennan. You know, we were talking earlier about the attitude to language and ongoing preoccupation, the way he's inviting the reader. You mentioned that, for example. Here's a very good example of that. Does it matter what the sky looked like, whether there was a high wind or not? And then he says, someone must, has to. Me, I suppose.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think that it's one thing that, as I particularly like about Banville's writing and this novel, that it calls us, our attention to those kind of moments. And it is that idea of fragmentation and taking a moment of possible luminosity or revelation and sort of presenting it to us in that kind of way. And I do think the words, and you talked about that extract there and about the fleshiness and the physicality of Mrs. Gray. I think that's one of the tensions within the novel, between that kind of fleshy worldliness, the thingness of the world, and then the words that we use to talk about the world.
Yes,
and how that either gets us closer to it or in some way maybe sets up a barrier.
Yeah, but he's asking, isn't he, where does fine description lead to? What does it add to our lives? You know, is he really, you know, you have two choices at that point, it seems to me. One is where you foreground language, the other is where you foreground observation and life itself.
I don't think that the language is used just for its own sake in the development of this narrative. Certainly in the way in which the development of the story with Mrs. Gray evolves. And there's a real kind of sensory language at play here.
And also, for example, if I may, a real sense of life where he's says, mothers won people we know as much. Brothers, yes, even sisters, but not mothers. You're miles away from language there. I mean, it's a real sort of valid social observation.
Yeah, and he's also looking at, with Mrs. Gray, and I'm not sure if it's in that passage, but it connects with that idea that because she's not a mother or a sister, he doesn't know where to categorise her and thinks that maybe she's a gender all to herself.
But certainly I think that the relationship between Mrs. Gray and young Alex is very interesting, because there's, as he puts it himself, there's all these kind of posturings on his part. The jealous lover, the pouting, upset young person who is not getting enough attention and so on. I mean, there's some wonderful moments in that. And what I find interesting, and you don't want to sort of give away plots and so on, is that she constantly remains a very interesting figure to us as readers and also to him, because there's something remains unknown about her.
Well, one of the things that actually connects the kind of contemporary plot with his investigation of the past and his relationship with Mrs. Gray is the whole idea of his bafflement. And that word is used a number of times. It's used in relation to his childhood and also in relation to his almost philosophical kind of bafflement as an adult.
The end point of that line is, I scarcely know myself. I mean, that's where he's heading with that.
Yeah, but he writes extremely well about the adolescent and the desire of the adolescent, the fascination of the adolescent, the discomfort, the emotional kind of turmoil that the child doesn't understand, I think is captured extremely well here. And also the way in which he never knows, as you say, he never knows Mrs. Gray. And she makes remarks about this, you know, and the fact that he knows very little about her.
What did you make of Cass, his daughter?
Well, she was a shadowy figure in the earlier novels. And again, she's necessarily shadowy here because she's taken her own life. What's interesting at some level is that, and again, it's that sort of fragmentation, that it's a lot of these characters are real only in terms of Cleve's relationship to them. You know what I mean? They don't exist outside his own sort of imagination of them. I think there was a hint perhaps of another novel at the end, if you know, the idea of trying to find out more about Axel Vander and Cass and so on. But I think, again, it's that this is where the doubling is going on, and the echo from the past to the present is that Cass remains a mystery to her father. Something has happened. He's had a relationship. He knows that he did things incorrectly, perhaps, but she's important to him, but he can't quite say exactly the nature of that relationship beyond love, obviously. But maybe that's the thing is, what else can you say? That the word love itself cannot encapsulate.
Which he plays around with, indeed. But the easy way we use it, of course, is all of that. So the scenes about the filmmaking are quite good, aren't they? They really register. One very well-observed point that a cast of actors is somehow more unruly than any other gathering, impatiently awaiting something, a command, a direction.
I think that the material, as Marcy Merriweather from Hollywood would call it, about that Banville includes in the novel, really presents, you were saying there's a kind of tragic side to it. I would see it actually as essentially kind of comic terms of the novel, and that it lifts it out of this investigation of the past into looking at the kind of coarseness, as Banville writes about it, of the film world, and also leads him to be able to investigate, as Dawn Devenport says, this isn't life, the world of the film.
Yes.
We need to live.
But I think the idea of using an actor as sort of the main character is interesting, the idea of play acting, of making up, of learning somebody else's lines. And he's very self-conscious about that. You know, he spent his whole life on stage trying not to be himself, which suggests that's exactly what he's running away from.
Yes, you know.
I mean, I thought it was well used in the previous novels, and moving it into the movies, I think, was, you know, it's updating, you know, that engagement with the idea of, well, creativity, that whole world, I suppose, of art. Because he says that about the movies, that I had been warned that it's fragmentary, that it's disconnected. But of course, as we know, the end product brings coherence and order to what seems, disconnected and so on. I think the idea of him as an actor and then as somebody trying to write about the past, it brings together, I think, some of, you know, Banville's philosophical concerns, I suppose. And as you say, bafflement been one, a concern with identity, who you are, what
and
you
about
might
the
be.
Fragmentary nature of the self and so on. But we've had... where is he going with those, really? I mean, they're kind of... Are they just dropped in? Or to what are these really recurring obsessions, things that he's really worried about?
I think they're just questions that drive his characters along. They're things that he's obviously interested in. I don't know where he can go with this in terms of another novel, if you know what I mean, because will it be more of the same, or can he sort of move it on? I don't know if he thinks in that
way. I mentioned at the outset, Julia, about him as the sort of painter monkey. There's a passage here where he says, in the pub, he has a vertiginous sensation. I think that's Alex Cleve, which he sometimes experiences when he looks at other people. I mean, really look, which I don't often do and which no one does often, I expect. This is very much the heart of it, isn't it?
Another kind of similar observation that he makes is that particularly when the people that he loves, the people that he's closest to, when he becomes involved with them, really what he sees is himself. So this is someone, in a sense, who's always looking in the mirror. The only thing that breaks through that in terms of, and it's interesting in terms of the title of the novel, is the idea of ancient light and the way in which, for a moment, and it's used, it's interesting the way in which it's used, because it's used at the most literal level when Mrs. Gray says that ancient light is what the householder has a right to. The householder has to be able to see the sky outside of his or her window. But then it's also used in terms of the galaxies, and everywhere we look, we are looking into the past.
On that very point, I mean, his cosmos, if you like, is one of gods, not a single god. I mean, it's a Greek pre-Christian world, really, isn't it?
Well, and it is. Like the previous novel, The Infinity, sort of played with that, as have the more recent novels, an acknowledgement of, as you say, that sort of Greek world of the gods. And I think it captures, I suppose, Banville's perception of life in a very Piketty sort of way, that, you know, we think we're in control, but in fact we're not. Life is more absurd than it is tragic, in that kind of way, or heroic, that we are the playthings of some controlling being or beings that we know very little of.
There is a lovely passage where he writes about the luminous everlasting present and the frail afterworld of these words. And the idea of language, in a sense, it brings it back to your discussion of language, the idea of, in the end, language is what remains.
The primary reality, in a sense. Yeah. But how do you see the connection with Benjamin Black? How do you read that? The two B's.
The two B's. I don't know. I've always found the Benjamin Black interesting because in many ways all of Banville's work has been about identity and about creating personas like a Copernicus or a Kepler or an Alexander Cleve and so on. And then he sort of goes the whole hog, as it were, and decides to create an alter ego for himself, this Benjamin Black. And there is a different quality to the Benjamin Black novels. They do have, in essence, similar concerns to a novel such as this, or indeed The Sea, about the past, for instance, like 1950s Dublin, that the Benjamin Black novels are set in. And yet they rush along in a way that these novels slow us down.
I think that's the essence of it. You know, I think great writers do that.
Yeah.
And he's a great writer.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that perhaps because the Benjamin Black novels are so accessible, I think that there is a kind of, certainly I'd be aware of a kind of loosening in terms of a text like this, in terms of storytelling, and that the storytelling is very much in the foreground here. And coming back to what I said in the very beginning, that I found this very accessible. I found it a comic novel, and I'd like to stress that, that this is, I mean, much of the discussion that we've been having suggests that it's a novel which is very philosophical and so on. But in fact, it's also a very comic novel in which there are a lot of comic episodes. And as again, very accessible for a reader.
We've been discussing Ancient Light by John Banville, published by Viking. My thanks to Julia Carlson and Derek Hand. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and also on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.